And of course, Barry Schwartz with us. We're going to take your phone calls as we talk about the Shroud of Turin right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Barry. Again, the Catholic Church doesn't seem to really be pushing or promoting the Shroud of Turin. Why not?
Well, I'm not sure I agree, George, because they just announced on December 4th that Pope Francis has authorized a public exhibition of the Shroud in 2015.
Well, now that's a first, isn't it?
Well, the last one was in 2010. The next one was scheduled for 2025.
Wow.
And Pope Francis, who is the only one who can kind of override what the previous pope said, has said that he thought it would be good under his watch for the public to get to see it again. He apparently has an interest in the Shroud. We don't really know exactly what his interest is yet. But they've already announced that on May 24th of 2015, the Pope would go up to Turin to see the Shroud himself. So I think that the Church recognizes that there is an interest in it and that it's of a broad interest, not just within the Catholic community, but outside of it as well. And there are a lot of people who go see the Shroud who aren't there for necessarily for religious reasons, but are either curious or just want to see this object that they've heard so much about in person on one of its rare public exhibitions. So I think the Church recognizes its merit. They've never taken a stand on its authenticity, so they've always sort of hedged their bets a bit on that. But I understand why. Look, science hasn't been able to answer the question, so the Church doesn't feel that they should make any declarations about it, and I think that's a wise decision. But I think they do encourage people to see it and to understand that, if nothing else, it's certainly a depiction of what was done to Jesus in the most graphic manner possible outside of Mel Gibson's movie. So I think that the Church does have an interest in promoting it, but they do it very carefully and very slowly. Historically, four times a century was the norm, and in the last 100 or so years, it's been shown more often than it has throughout its previous history as far as numbers of, at public exhibitions.
Okay, good. So, I did not know the Church was that active trying to get the word out about this.
Well, it's hard to say that it's the Church as an institution doing it. The legal owner of the Shroud is the Holy See, the living Pope, and not the institution of the Church itself. When King Umberto died in 1983, he decided to leave the Shroud not to the Church, which would require 120 cardinals to make any decisions about it, but to the living Pope, so that one man with his appropriate advisors would be able to make decisions about the Shroud without having to go through a large committee.
That's almost like an executive presidential order. You just do it.
Sort of.
But isn't the Church the Pope, realistically?
Well, sure, and I'm certainly not an expert on the Catholic Church, but it is in a sense, but the legal ownership transferred when Pope Benedict retired last year and Pope Francis was elected, he immediately became the legal owner of the Shroud of Turin. And that was the way King Umberto's will was written.
As long as he's the Pope.
As long as he's the Pope. When he passes on, whether it's by his passing or by retirement, as Pope Benedict did, the next pope would then become the next legal owner. This was done very carefully and done legally. It went through the courts. It took several years, and it wasn't until 1985 that the final will was probated and the legal ownership of the Shroud passed to the living pope. The only other stipulation the king made is that it must remain in Turin, because so much of Turin's fame comes from the Shroud. Of course, it had the Olympics back there in 2010. But also, what is little known about Turin, it's also the seat of devil worship in Western Europe. And somebody asked me, well, why would that be the case? And my answer is, well, look, if you've got what is ostensibly the most important relic of Christianity there, you don't think the opposition will be there, too? So it seems to me that, the fact that there is so much interest in it from both sides of the spectrum, both from those who accept that it's authentic or believe that it's authentic, either from their faith or from the science or the history, and those who are absolutely adamant against it under any circumstances, that reject all the science and reject everything about it. Seems to me there's a yin and a yang of a plus and a minus going on. And in my mind, why are the skeptics so adamant about it unless they fear that it may well be the real thing, I guess? I can't speak to that, although, you know, I've debated several skeptics, including, I think, on your show. So the way I see it is this. In the end, the church can promote it, and they can say, look, we think it's worthy of veneration, but they've never proclaimed it authentic. And I think that that's probably a wise decision on their part, at least at this point in time. Who knows? I mean, the science keeps getting better, and if another examination is permitted at some point in the future, we might be able to get some of the answers to the questions, including perhaps how this image formed by interacting with an ostensibly dead body.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Wildcard Dana is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Welcome to the program. Hello, Dana. Good morning.
Hi, George. Hi, Barry. George,
hi, Dana. How are you?
Great shows tonight, both of them.
Thank
equally,
you.
Equally impressive. Barry, I have a question for you. I am a Roman Catholic, and I have a really strong relationship with God. And I'm sure, I'm assuming you're aware of stories that, not stories as in fables, but, you know, there have been over the years bodies of various saints exhumed, and they are perfectly preserved, and there is no explanation. Well, using your mother's reasoning, I've always reasoned that the shroud, it never, you know, disintegrated, just like your mother said, just like the bodies of these saints. And so my question to you is that you've already admitted it, it's real, your mother has, and after staring in the face of the Son of God, have you and or your mother become Christian? And if not, why?
Okay, good question. No, my mother has not, nor have I. Now, generally, Jews that come to accept Jesus as the Messiah are known as Messianic Jews. They're sometimes called Christians. Sometimes they call themselves Christians. Often they call themselves completed Jews. That's what my Messianic friends call themselves. And people ask me the question all the time. And I always say, look, I haven't ruled out that as a possibility. But being a Jew, being someone who came into this completely skeptical, I mean completely skeptical, one of the impacts the Shroud has had on my life, and I'll share this on the air tonight, after we built Shroud.com and I started to speak publicly about it, people started asking me the question you asked me, Dana, and that's, what do you believe? And I didn't have an answer. I'd walked away from Judaism when I was a kid and never looked back. God wasn't part of my life throughout most of my adult life. But here I am now sort of representing something that's so important to so many people's faith, and I feel that I'm obligated to give honest answers. So here I am, age 51 or so, and forced to confront my own beliefs for the first time as an adult. And because I was raised in an Orthodox home and God was part of everything every day, when I did look in my heart, I found God had been there all along. And so I found God not in a church or a synagogue, but right inside myself. And how many Jews can say that the Shroud of Turin led them back to their faith in God? Well, I can say that. So I'm on a good path, and I'm going to tell you the same thing I told a lady who asked me the same question in a church, a Catholic church, actually, back in Stockton, California. She put it more bluntly. She said, Barry, have you accepted Jesus as your Lord and Savior? And when I said no, she started to cry. And I instantly recognized that was love coming from her, and she wanted me to feel what she felt. And so I'm going to give you the answer I gave her. I said, look, this was never my idea. I didn't choose myself to do this. Apparently, God wanted me to do this, and perhaps in God's point of view, having a Jewish guy representing the Shroud would certainly create some curiosity, if nothing else. And if it's okay with God to have a Jew be the messenger and bring this information, it should be okay with everybody. But then here's the best part of the answer. I always tell everybody, relax, I'm not dead yet. So I didn't expect to be here today talking about the Shroud of Turin, yet here I am. So I don't know where I'll be tomorrow. So keep me in your prayers. And like I said, I'm not dead yet. We'll see where it leads me. But right now, I believe I serve God being exactly who I am.
Barry, if the shroud is authentic and Christ's existence is authentic, what does that tell you personally? What does that tell you?
Personally, first of all, look, I don't deny the existence of Christ. He's much too important a figure to have not existed, and I know there are people who deny his existence. I don't put myself in that category. And I believe that he did exist. And whether or not he was the Messiah, I haven't yet come to a final decision on that personally. But I think what the shroud does is it sort of, in some ways, forces the issue. It makes you confront your beliefs, as it did with me, and I know it's done that for many others. Recently, a Baptist minister heard one of my lectures and afterwards wrote me and said, well, after hearing what you had to say about it and you answering my questions, I have to accept the shroud's authentic. And I wrote him back and I said, that may be the first time a Baptist minister has ever uttered those words, because the Baptists historically are not very interested in the shroud. They see it as another one of the myriad of Catholic relics. So I think that the significance of the shroud overall, both for me and for everybody, is it's something there that's tangible, unlike so much of faith in all denominations that rely on simply accepting, here's something tangible. Here's something that documents the torture this man suffered. And that, to me, is something that can reinforce people's faith. You know, some people are very deep in their faith, strong in their faith. They don't need the shroud or anything else. But I always remind people there was that man named Thomas in the Gospels, and so I think Jesus understood doubt. So what does it all mean? Well, you know, I'll be honest with you, George. In my personal life, one of the things in learning about the shroud, and having to learn about the New Testament and what Jesus said, I have to be honest, you know, the Jews have the Ten Commandments, 794 rules in the Mishnah, and so many other things. They've had 5,700 years to sit around and debate every word. Jesus summed it up so simply, and I'm paraphrasing, he basically said, love God and love one another. Well, for me, that was so much more meaningful than going to Hebrew school and listening and reading the Torah and all these things that I've done. I've been to countless Catholic masses and in different congregations, and I've never felt closer to God than when I discovered him right in my own heart. So I try and practice what Jesus preached. I think it's a great way to go through life. I think it encapsulates everything the Old Testament sort of made as rules, but simplified it down to the core two rules: loving God, loving one another. If you follow those two, it's pretty hard to break any of the rest.
Yeah,
so I think that the shroud has value for anyone who seriously confronts it, whether they are Christian or Jew or Muslim or anything else. There are many people who have studied the shroud, who have no religious interest in it at all, and yet have found themselves strengthened by their knowledge of it. So I think it serves a purpose, but it's different for each person. And that's why I constantly come back to my mantra, which is, here are the facts, you decide.
Let's go next to Brian in Houston, Texas. Good morning, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George. Ain't slept in years. Been listening to the show for about, 18 years.
Oh, thank you.
Anyway, my question is for Barry. I watched this show on one of the scientific channels, and if I remember correctly, it was either there's multiple shrouds or layers of shrouds. So if that's true, wouldn't there be more shrouds somewhere out there? And my comment is, I'm a spiritual person, not necessarily religious, but I kind of struggle with the duality of kind of between good and evil. And I was just hoping if y'all could do a mass consciousness, just kind of keep me on the side of light. And then I want to give a shout out to my bro in Houston. Love you guys. And George, man, a lot of respect.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate that. Good comments there. Go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, I'm not certain about multiple shrouds. In the Gospels, it talks about a separate cloth folded and separate from the main shroud. That would have been the face cloth that would have been put over his head when he was brought from the cross. Even to this day, we still cover the faces of those who passed away, whether it's on the side of the road in an accident or in the hospital or whatever. And so they would have done the same thing, but they would have taken that to the tomb. It would have had blood. It has blood and fluid stains in it. It's required by Jewish law that it be buried with the body. So it would have been kept in the tomb, separate from the main burial shroud, which it would have been removed, and he would have then been prepared and wrapped in the big shroud. So both, according to the Gospels, were in the tomb. But as far as multiple shrouds, the gentleman was talking about, I'm not quite sure what the reference there is. It's the fact that typical Jewish burial shroud is what we have on the Shroud of Turin. My father, when he died in 2003, had a Jewish, Orthodox Jewish burial, and he was wrapped in the shroud very much like the Shroud of Turin to this day, in a plain wooden box, body not embalmed, a very typical Jewish Orthodox ceremony. And so, but multiple shrouds, I'm not really sure how to answer that. Just remember this, though, that unlike most shrouds that stay around the body, this one got separated at some point, probably about within 36 hours of him being placed in the cloth.
Very close to what they say.
People talk about 3 days of Jesus being in the tomb, but that's 3 calendar days, starting Friday afternoon, evening, all day Saturday and Sunday morning, the tomb was empty. So he was only there about 36 hours. And there's no signs of any decomposition on the Shroud of Turin.
No.
So the body wasn't in it long enough for that to occur.
In those days, did they not crucify people the same way that we believe Christ was crucified? Thorns on the head, nailed to the cross?
The crown of thorns, to my knowledge, and that's only 36 years or so of studying this, was only done once, that was not typical. Scourging was typical for some people. Spearing in the side even might have been typical. Certainly the crucifixion was. They did countless numbers of those. But the crowning with thorns was only because Jesus had proclaimed himself the King of the Jews. And so to humiliate him, they gave him a crown to humiliate him, not to make him look good or to look nice for the painters that
right.
were going to come later and paint the event. So I think that, it's the crown of thorns, the bloodstains from that on the shroud, that more or less tell me this is only one man that we know of in all of recorded history who had those specific tortures applied, and they're forensically accurately documented on this piece of cloth. And their blood, not paint, as some have claimed, the blood chemistry says it's blood. Old blood, but blood no less. So I think that, pretty much everything about, look, trust me, I was not an easy person to convince about this, and it took me almost 20 years. And that's because I resisted, and I sort of looked for any excuse. Now I meet skeptics all the time that remind me of myself in my earlier days.
You've changed a lot, right?
I've changed a lot, and I never expected to do this, nor did I intend to do this, and yet this is what I do.
We're going to come back in just a moment with you, Barry. We'll take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM. Co-author Turin Shroud, and of course his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Shroud.com is the main one for you there. I'm going to be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM as well. We'll tell you what's in store again for our next Coast to Coast show. We'll be back. Those of you on hold, just hang where you are. We'll get right to you when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And again, tomorrow we're going to be talking about why some of these bankers are dying. A couple of them just jumped and committed suicide. Strange story there. Then we'll be talking with Major Ed Dames about remote viewing and his days in Kiev at the Ukraine. And he still has an apartment there, which is 2 blocks away from where all this trouble is mounting. So we'll get into that. Then on Friday, of course, we'll have open lines here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Barry Schwartz with us. Barry, the Shroud.com website has got to be the big website for anything on the Shroud, isn't it?
We are. I often have people kind of compliment me and say, hey, you're number one on Google. And my answer is always, we're 4 years older than Google. Because we
yeah,
just had
are.
Our 18th anniversary online in January, January 21st.
That's amazing.
We got to be number one, although, George, when I got on the internet with this, it was just a bunch of geeks and computer guys, And I don't know that anybody saw where it was. Well, a few people saw where they were going. Their name were Gates and Jobs and people like that. But the rest of us were there basically to share information and interact with other people. Of course, it grew into something far greater than any of us anticipated. And Shroud.com sort of rose to the top because for 18 years we've been building the archive there. And it's become the definitive internet archive for Shroud information.
What keeps driving you, Barry? You don't stop.
You know, George, I've asked myself that question a few times, and I think that I have to go back to 1978 and being in that room, and it occurred to me at some point that afterwards that there were a billion people on this planet who had more right to be in that room than I did. I was a total skeptic, not a Christian. It meant nothing to me emotionally and spiritually, and yet I was the one that was there. And my job was to document the event and gather this data. And I've always been somewhat of an archivist, a pack rat, collector, whatever. And I felt when our team ended our work in 1981, somehow I felt I hadn't finished what I'd begun. I had all this material, and it took all the way till 1996 before I found out that the best thing I could do with it would be to share it and to make that available to those who don't read scientific journals, who weren't there, who weren't part of our team, who didn't have access to what I had access to. And I felt an obligation that I'd been given this great privilege, and Shroud.com became the fulfillment of the obligation that came with that privilege. So I feel very honored to have been given this. Think about this. I've had a long, illustrious career in photography and video, and everything I've done has come and gone and passed and means nothing today. But the work with the Shroud of Turin will last beyond me. It becomes my legacy, and that I see as a gift. So I'm grateful to be given something to do. I'm 67. I'm retired, not out shooting anymore the way I used to. And to do this work has become a full-time job, running a nonprofit. Not so easy. Huh. It's a lot of work. And so I think what drives me now is knowing that I'm doing something that has meaning to people out there. And that's a great feeling to know that you're touching people by providing them with something that may be important to them.
All right, let's go west now. Tom is in Fallbrook, California. Get things started this segment. Hi,
George.
Tom. Hi. Good to have you with
Barry,
us.
You know, George, you had asked Barry at the start of this, what was his impact when he first saw the Shroud?
Mm-hmm.
I have an interesting story. My first job was an intern at JPL. And it was working in the photo lab, and I'd been there a couple of years. They brought this film in, asked me to process it, and I was not very religious at the time. And I'm sitting here, I start processing these images, watching them come up, and my knees almost buckle. And I looked at these pictures, first ones being processed, held above, couldn't believe it. Had to take the negatives outside, looked at the negatives through the light just to see what I was looking at. And for me, it was, when I processed those pictures that were brought back, it was profound.
What did you see? What was there?
For me?
Yeah.
The pictures that you're most commonly looking at now, for me, I looked at this is, I knew very little about what the Shroud was. And a guy next to me, my lab partner, started explaining to me about the Shroud and its basis. And I felt like I was looking at Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you get that feeling, that impression.
And I, for the rest of my life, I'll never forget that. Every time I start to waver, I go back to that time when I was processing those pictures, looking at his wounds, looking at the crown of thorns. For me, it was a life-changing event.
Let me ask you, if I can, Tom, at JPL, why would you have film of the Shroud?
The film was brought back to JPL for image analysis.
Okay.
That's correct.
Okay.
Did you know Don Lynn?
Vaguely.
Okay,
yes,
because he was my hero there. He was the imaging project manager on Voyager, Viking, Mariner, Galileo. So you were there during those days.
Yeah, he was an intern.
Oh, yeah, I was. I ended up doing a lot of radar image processing and doing stuff on the shuttle and later on down the road. But this was my first major, major impact, and life-changing.
Tom, did they show you any pictures of the moon or anything like that? might as well ask.
Primarily how I spent my next 10 years.
Anything unusual there?
Yeah. You know, I hear everyone talk about that and
structures,
setting
things.
A lot of radar imagery, et cetera. I never saw anything that just totally blew my mind. Let's put it that way. But I used to daily, I would look at all these pictures coming through, and I'm just fascinated by it.
There's some great things there. Barry, this still, I think, you know, is one of the great stories of all times. I had an opportunity to interview a guest who wrote a book on Rabbi Kadyrie. He's not with us anymore. He lived until he was 108. And he believed that the Messiah, and he's Jewish, of course, a Jewish rabbi, he believed that the Messiah was Jesus, you know, which went totally opposite of what those of the Jewish faith believe.
George, in my more recent years, I've done a lot more traveling and lecturing and met many Messianic Jewish groups, but was one in, I was in Minnesota at the end of last year, invited by a Messianic group. So there were Jews who had come to accept Jesus as the Messiah.
Yeah.
So it's not that unusual. There are many Jews who have done that. There are many Jews who, certainly from the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox side, don't accept Jesus because they believe he didn't fulfill all the prophecies that were prophesied in the Old Testament. And look, it's the kind of thing that, you know, one can split hairs. I think that whatever path one takes that leads them to a spiritual place is a good path, but that path is going to be different for probably for each one of us. And so I see the Shroud as a guidepost. It sort of points in a direction, but it doesn't make you do anything. That's something that each individual has to do on their own. So I think the Shroud is there maybe as a symbol, maybe as a beacon, if you will. But think about this. In the world we live in today, anything that makes you stop and consider your beliefs, your faith, God, can't be a bad thing in this world that we live in today. So I see the Shroud as a positive thing. And it means something different. I mean, you could ask 20 different people what it means and probably get 20 different responses. So from my point of view, it's there. It's important to those who find it important, and it's irrelevant to those who have no interest in it. And, you know, each person has to kind of figure it out on his own.
So
I don't think there's ever going to be a single answer.
Can we get any DNA off the Shroud?
Yeah, there was some DNA analysis done from Shroud blood back in 1995 at the University of Texas Health Science Center. Dr. Victor Tryon and Steve Mattingly. Dr. Tryon was a DNA expert. He did an analysis, was able to determine that it was male human blood. He was able to determine that the chromosomes seemed to be normal, but the segments were so degraded and so few because of age and exposure, you know, to the air and everything, that no full profile could be obtained. Now, we know, first of all, DNA analysis is a comparative analysis, so you got to have a profile to compare it to. I don't know anybody who's got a verified DNA of Jesus to compare it with, so that's going to be a problem. The other thing is this, the degradation of the DNA over time. Remember, this cloth has been hung out in the sun and displayed on balconies and held and handled and cried over and kissed and touched. So there's a lot of DNA all over that, including my own. I breathed on it, leaned over it, touched it. So my DNA is on there too. So with DNA technology having evolved to where it has now, where they can perform some of these tests very quickly, I think it would be probably worthwhile at some point in the future to do perhaps mitochondrial DNA testing on it, which hasn't been done, and, of course, applying some of the newer DNA technologies to it. Again, not in my field of expertise. My only point when people bring it up is, relax, they're not going to clone Jesus from the blood of the Shroud and create the Antichrist. There have been several books and even, I think, a movie and a television program that had that as a theme. it doesn't appear that that's going to be scientifically possible, but it makes for good fiction. But in reality, it's not what's going to happen. So DNA analysis still can prove useful, especially perhaps in comparing it to other blood-soaked relics like the sudarium of Oviedo, which I mentioned earlier, which would be most likely that face cloth that was mentioned in the Gospels.
Yeah.
If, in fact, these two cloths are related, then the blood on those two cloths should have should match. And so that comparison's never been made. So there's still plenty of things that DNA could tell us. It might not tell us, you know, who the man of the shroud is. But what it would tell us, for example, if you compare the shroud to the sudarium and the DNA is the same, think about this, George. The sudarium is documented back to the 6th century. So if they made that comparison, that would be another piece of evidence against the 1988 results of carbon dating that says it's medieval in origin, because if the blood is the same and these two cloths wrapped the same man, then the shroud has to be much older than that radiocarbon dating says it was.
Let's go to Robert in South Bend, Indiana. Robert, thank you for holding. Go ahead.
How are you doing tonight, George?
Good, Robert.
Big fan.
Thank you, sir.
I got a question. How can you explain the image that everybody sees on the shroud is more in line with the pictures that everybody has hanging on their wall versus what it says in the Bible and describing Jesus as a being dark of skin and curly of hair or woolly of hair?
Well, first of all, we can't judge hair or skin color from the shroud. There's no color information in.
Oh, I understand. I understand that. But there's still the European features
actually,
that you could see on the shroud.
Well, yeah, let me respond to that. Actually, a study was done by two Italian researchers, I believe in 1999 or 2000. What they did, it was called an anthropometric study. They took the image of the shroud, they measured the length of the legs, the long bones, typical things that anthropologists, forensic anthropologists use. There are guidelines for bone length for different cultures and different races. And the determination made from the Shroud of Turin is this is a Semitic man. Well, that's what Jesus was. So, you know, the scientific evidence points in that direction. To my knowledge, there isn't a really good description of Jesus in the Gospels. So perhaps, and I'm not an expert on the Gospels, so perhaps I'm wrong about that. But from what I understood, there was no description, so we really don't know what he looked like. I would point out to this gentleman, though, that we all recognize that man as Jesus. This is a man that lived 2,000 years ago, and yet everybody on this planet looks at that and goes, yeah, that's what, and look at all the artworks throughout history going all the way back to, I believe, the 4th century, always depicting Jesus looking like the man of the shroud. And you can look at all the iconography, and almost every icon looks like that man of the shroud. So perhaps the shroud was the model for many of the early icons. Perhaps they saw it and patterned their artwork on what they saw. But so I'm not certain that I totally agree with the caller in the fact that the scientific evidence does point to a Semitic man. And the hair doesn't look curly, but also remember the hair, his hair would have been matted with sweat and blood. They gave him no water. They beat him severely. His hair would have been very stiff and matted. So, you know, what can we judge from that? Well, we have what we have on the shroud. I believe that it's consistent with the Gospels. The real biblical experts who've studied both the Gospels and the shroud agree. So I'm not certain I agree with the caller on the description of Jesus in the Gospels.
Okay, let's take one or two more calls here. Next up, we go to Jack in Park Ridge, Illinois. Jack, let's get you in here. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, Jack.
Hi. My question is, Barry, well, I live in Park Ridge next to O'Hare Airport, and I picked up the Los Angeles Fire Department on my scanner on their old frequencies because every time there was an earthquake, the day before, I'd hear the calls. Now, you know how animals get upset because of earthquakes and
mm-hmm.
stuff. Well, it's the gases that get released from the earth, I read in the magazine, that affects radio waves. Now, would these gases affect the shroud also? that get released from the earth.
And Jack, I just saw you at the UFO conference in Scottsdale, didn't I?
No, I was not.
You weren't there?
No.
Okay, I thought you were. That's all right. Let's get that answered if we can. We're almost out of time, Barry.
Look, that's sort of what these researchers that just published this article recently were saying, that they believe those gases, which would have had neutron radiation in them, might have impacted the shroud, may have created the image. But there's no scientific evidence to support that. What evidence we have about radiation points away from radiation. That doesn't mean that it could be some form of radiation that was very attenuated, very modest amount, but we don't know. So, you know, it's easy to speculate, and there's plenty of speculation in the world of the shroud, and some of the article that was published there is speculative in nature. But, you know, look, again, this is something that has come up several times in the last few decades. And so I think by this article coming out, it may prompt some researchers to go a little further into it and determine once and for all whether or not an earthquake might have had some involvement with the shroud, either its image or in skewing the carbon
dating. Well, you know, as they say, one of the greatest stories ever told, isn't it, Barry?
Yeah.
Sure is. Stay in touch with us, my friend. Love your work.
Dr.
Barry Schwartz, of course, the shroudofturin.com. He's one of the best when it comes to that. There's another one out of St. Louis, Mark Antonacci. He is fantastic as well. They just do great research. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lone Hood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.